From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The U.S. stock market is taking a hit today as investors react to another development in an escalating trade war. China said today that it will impose a 25% tariff on more than 100 categories of U.S. products, which will affect goods worth about $50 billion. The move is retaliation for President Trump's announcement yesterday that he's putting tariffs on an equivalent amount of Chinese products coming into the U.S. Today on CNBC, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross downplayed the tit-for-tat.
This $50 billion that they're talking about amounts to about 0.3% of our GDP. So it's hardly a life-threatening activity.
For more on this, we're joined now by Emily Glazer. She's a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Emily.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. So with these tariffs, Beijing is putting soybeans and airplanes directly into its sights, but a lot more, too. What else?
So just hours after the Trump administration unveiled plans to impose tariffs on Chinese products, we've seen China retaliate. The Chinese list is targeting 106 types of U.S. goods. And that's a lot less than the Trump list, which would impact 1,300 categories of goods. Mm. But the Chinese list has a lot more high-profile goods. Soybeans and smaller commercial passenger planes, mostly made by Boeing, are the most valuable U.S. exports to China, and they were worth about $23 billion last year.
Let's spend a little time talking about soybeans. A quarter of soybeans grown in the United States are exported to China, and they're coming from an area that voted for President Trump. What's the impact on the farm industry? They must be watching this very closely.
Oh, absolutely. China is by far the largest foreign buyer of U.S. soybeans. Those are on the ground into meal for animal feed and processed into vegetable oil, among the other products. The American Soybean Association estimated that losses in the soybean market amounted to a $1.7 billion hit to the value of the U.S. soybean crop. So they are immediately raising fears that China's move could slice billions of dollars from the value of U.S. crops. And some farmers are pondering changes to their crop plans, with planting just weeks away for many in the farm belt.
Wow. So you've also got these big blue chip companies, companies like Boeing, Intel, Apple. They sell a ton of product to China. So the question is, is there truth to what we heard Wilbur Ross say today, that the $50 billion amounts to a tiny fraction of the U.S. GDP and that this is not life-threatening activity?
While it's hard to argue with numbers, you can't argue with impact. So what we're seeing right now with some of these large U.S. companies, you know, aerospace giant Boeing has fallen upon this news. Heavy machinery firm Caterpillar's stock is dropping. Technology firms like semiconductor maker NVIDIA is sliding. And microchips are traded heavily between the U.S. and China. Mm-hmm. So while Wilbur Ross is certainly not saying anything inaccurate about numbers, we also can't ignore the impact. And a lot of investors are worried that these trade policies could result in higher costs for manufacturers of, you know, everything from computer chips to smartphones, and that could lead to a slowdown in corporate activity and weaker global economic growth.
As we see the stock market respond, as it has yet again today, to these announcements, do you see any pressure building on the president to soften his position a little bit? I mean, because, you know, he has made such claims that he has been good for the stock market. He's got to be feeling pressure over this if it continues.
It's a great question. You know, we've seen the president comment or tweet about economic growth before, how well the stock market's been doing. There's been a lot of optimism around that, just given how much it's risen during his presidency. But China's retaliatory tariffs on American goods have caused stocks to plummet around the world across a wide range of sectors, and we can't ignore that. So it'll be very interesting to see what the president may or may not say, given this kind of impact.
Because quickly, Emily, there is some wiggle room for negotiation and some time to figure this out still?
Yes, it's very interesting because neither the U.S. nor the Chinese tariffs take effect immediately. And that's really important to keep in mind. Some of my colleagues at The Wall Street Journal have reported some folks saying that China will perhaps enforce its penalties depending on the outcome of negotiations between the two sides. Mm-hmm. So it really depends. There's quite some time. U.S. companies have until May 22nd to raise objections. And there's another 180 days after that comment period to decide whether to go ahead or not.
All right. Emily Glazer, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
50 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot dead as he stood on a balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. He was 39 years old, and tonight bells will toll 39 times at 6:01 Central Time. That was when the single gunshot that killed King was fired. Events in his hometown of Atlanta will culminate with a wreath laying at his crypt. Martin Luther King III has said that he wants his father's message to now take hold.
My hope is that we learn how to not just idolize him, but to embrace the ideals that he personified, so that we can create a peaceful and just and humane and civil society.
On the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death, new biographies reveal new facets of his life, including his connections to Boston and to Robert Kennedy. Fred Tice from member station WBUR begins with the civil rights leader's ties to Boston University.
BU is where King became Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's also where he chose to become a civil rights leader. He came to BU to pursue a doctorate in theology in 1951.
He was studying systematic theology, which is sort of like the most philosophical branch of theology. It's the most sort of heady and sort of removed from the day-to-day.
BU archivist Ryan Hendrickson says at BU, King came under the influence of a professor named Alan Knight Chalmers, who had been a leader in earlier civil rights struggles.
King is very interested in this because, you know, he's trying to decide for his life, does he want to be, you know, a kind of a pastor in a very high-class church in the South, or does he want to go into social activism? He almost doesn't make that choice until he goes to Montgomery to become a pastor there, right at the time that the bus boycott starts.
King became pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery in 1954, and he would play a leading role in the boycott the next year.
Just the other day, just last Thursday to be exact, one of the finest citizens in Montgomery, amen, not one of the finest Negro citizens, yeah, right, but one of the finest citizens in Montgomery, was taken from a bus and carried to jail and arrested because she refused to get up to give her seat to a white person.
Some of the documents from the Montgomery bus boycott are on exhibit at Boston University. Ryan Hendrickson is assistant director for manuscripts and reads from a leaflet passed out by boycott organizers after they won.
The whole bus is now for the use of all people. Take a vacant seat. Yeah. Oh, and do not deliberately sit by a white person unless there's no other seat. Yeah. The idea was not to be provocative, I think, right? And not to sort of, when sitting down by a person, white or colored, say, may I, or pardon me as you sit. This is a common courtesy.
King donated his papers to BU in 1964. He came to Boston from Crozer Seminary in Upland, Pennsylvania. Author Patrick Parr says three Crozer professors recommended BU.
I'd say on his mind was, I got to stay in the North for a little while longer. He was not ready to go back South. At that point, if he doesn't go to Boston, what's waiting for him is a life in Atlanta, and that's with his father. And he's going to stay in the shadow of his father. He's going to be a co-pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta and kind of wait until his father retires.
Parr's new book, The Seminarian, out this week, is about King's life just before coming to Boston when he attended Crozer. Another book, The Promise and the Dream, explores the relationship between King and Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General from 1961 to 1964. Author David Margolick says he found that relationship was much more complicated than he'd anticipated.
Martin Luther King was always asking for help from the Justice Department and always frustrated in the lack of response. He was always asking that civil rights leaders and civil rights workers be protected in the South, and invariably he got the same response from the Justice Department and from Kennedy, which is that we're not policemen. We can't send people down there to protect you. That's the job of the local police.
Margolick says King felt that the Justice Department never did its job. Still, he says, in the end, Robert Kennedy became a better friend to the black community than his brother John, and by the 1968 presidential primaries, it was clear that King's heart was with Kennedy. On the night of April 4, 1968, as riots erupted across the country, Kennedy ignored advice to cancel a campaign stop in an African-American neighborhood in Indianapolis and announced King's death from the back of a truck, clutching crumpled notes he never once looked at.
For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man.
There was no rioting in Indianapolis that night. I'm Fred Tice.
Fans of Jane Austen know that the author of Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice never published under her own name. Austen began writing in the late 1700s to entertain her family. Music was very much a part of their gatherings, too. Here's one of her favorite pieces. Austen and her siblings gathered their favorite musical pieces and compiled them in family music books. That was a practice common at the time. Let's find out more now from Samantha Carrasco, who's a member of the Austen Trio, which has a new CD coming out. Samantha, tell us about the Austen family music books.
Back in the sort of late 18th century, in the absence of CDs and records, a lot of family entertainment would have been little soirees and groups of people getting together and performing. Jane Austen talks about how she used to play with her nephews and nieces and playing dances, and one person would play and then dances would be taught. It was very much part of the family structure and the family setup of an entertainment in an evening.
And so Jane Austen herself compiled some of these books for the Austen family, what you're calling now the Austen family music books that you now perform. But she had a hand in, literally a hand in putting them together.
Yes, what's so fascinating about the music books themselves is they're an absolute collection of different people's tastes and aspirations in some respects. So the collection, it's not one particular genre of music. There's music from the theatre, which Jane was very fond of. There's some political songs, and there's also a large collection of music which has come over directly from France, belonging to Jane Austen's cousin. So the family would then perhaps swap or lend these music books so that other members of the family could copy it out by hand. So this is where it gets rather interesting, because Jane Austen had painstakingly copied some of this printed music. She's got an extremely elegant hand. Everything has got a very specific neatness to it.
This is perfect. You must have thought that when you saw it. you can see her writing, but it's not even words. It's notes.
Yeah, it's very, very crazy when you're actually just handling a manuscript like that, which is in some respects somebody else's music, but in her hand. And the meaning of that is very, very humbling.
Let's listen to another piece now of music by Johann Kramer. And this is a sonata based on God Save the King, and it's actually one of the few musical pieces that Jane Austen named in a novel herself. ¶¶
there's various examples of these national anthems within the Jane Austen music collection and the Austen family music collection. I think the Austens obviously were sort of very patriotic. They've got family at sea, at war at this time, and there's a lot of uncertainty politically. And it's interesting that in their own personal collection of music that they would have such a sort of patriotic example interwoven within the music.
Samantha, that's you playing, and Jane Austen played the piano, so maybe in the living room of her home, the parlor, she would have been playing it too?
Absolutely. In many respects, you know, I think tastes grow and change as they go along, and perhaps some of the sort of flamboyant theatrical songs that she may have, you know, liked, you know, in her youth, you know, then would have gone into slightly more political songs a bit later. Who knows? One of the other pieces, which was one of her favourites, was written by Robert Burns.
You're talking about Robert Burns, the Scottish poet. The piece is called There Groves of Sweet Myrtle.
There groves of sweet myrtle, let foreign lands reckon, where bright beaming summers exalt the perfume.
This particular song was special to her, as the words have been changed. And what is, you know, in the original sort of Burns Scott song as the charms of his Jean, it's the charms of his Jane. And they're slightly changed, sort of, you know, in Jane Austen's hand. And
you mean she made it Jane instead of Jean?
Yes, yeah. Wow. So it's, and she did it a couple of, this is the sort of second example that you can find of it. There's another song about a soldier which was changed she changed it to a sailor, perhaps, you know, thinking about her sailor brother, you know, but quite why she changed these things is all sort of is part of this sort of shroud of mystery in some respects.
That's Helen Neves, who is part of the group. She's a soprano. Who would do the singing in the Austen household?
Caroline, her niece, describes her as singing frequently, and her sister Cassandra would have sung. And we have to sort of transfer our minds back at 200 years, really, to think about what we would do for our own entertainment. And piano in the room, perhaps when the light was going, candles by the piano, that idea of somebody entertaining and singing and enjoying a song and telling a story. People would ask for requests of certain things which they would like, or, you know, sing us that song again, you know, Auntie Jane, sort of thing.
What about the French love song that was part of the Austen collection?
So Jane's cousin, Eliza de Faïd, lived in Paris, and when she was there, she had a monthly subscription of songs and harp pieces, as she was a harpist. These subscriptions very, very abruptly stopped at the point where, you know, the French Revolution started to really take grip, and this sort of terror formed, and Eliza de Faïd had to flee from Paris. And this particular song was written by Jean-Baptiste Krumpholz.
The song is about heartbreak. I'd like to end on the grand duet for harp and piano, Opus 72, by Jan Ladislav Dusek, who fled the French Revolution. And as we close out, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the piece, and also just about what you learn from this music about Jane Austen, about the Austen family, and what they were like together at home.
So the Dusek piece is a very energetic piece, and the harp and piano duo was a very sort of popular formulation back in the 18th century. Perhaps the lady would have been playing the harp and the man would have been playing the piano. And the actual piece itself is very energetic. It's got lots of characteristic sort of changes and florid runs and impressive sort of changeover of melody from harp to piano, and a sort of flirtatious conversation in some respects, if you like, between the harpist and the pianist. And in terms of, you know, what the music has taught me and how I understand it, the whole collection has really sort of really brings out such an enormous different sort of collection of styles. The main thing is that they're all at very different levels. There's very small examples of children's drawing treble clefs in some of the manuscript books and teaching a sort of pedagogical role, and then there's some nursery rhymes where you sort of start drawing the clefs and learning your notes, and then it goes right through to something rather more virtuosic by Dussek, the grand duet for harp and piano, which requires a lot more technique than, say, some of the more simple one-handed, you know, one melody songs with a simple chordal accompaniment. So it's a combination of all these different styles, like in the novels, the various characters have all got different musical expertise, you know, the skill of, say, Jane Fairfax in contrast to Mary in Pride and Prejudice, who can barely sort of romp through a little sort of simple dance without embarrassing herself. You know, it's reflected in the novels as much as it is in the music and in the music collection itself.
Samantha Carrasco, a member of the Austin Trio, nice to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
More than 20,000 teachers from Oklahoma's 10 largest school districts are walking out of the classroom for a third day today. The teachers are among the lowest paid in the country. They're asking for higher wages and more money for their schools, which have seen per-pupil funding cut by nearly 30% over the last decade. Emily Wendler is covering the walkout for State Impact Oklahoma, a statewide public radio collaborative. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
You're welcome.
This is the third day of this walkout. What's the mood like where you are?
I think people are still really riled up. They feel like they're making progress, and they don't want to give up on the progress that they've made so far. The pressure of the walkout likely is the reason lawmakers passed a teacher pay raise last week, and that was a historic movement, so they're going to keep pushing for more.
Let's talk about that. As you say, teachers already got a raise, $6,100 on average, and they also got some more money for their schools. Your governor, Mary Fallon, told CBS News that the teachers were acting like teenage kids that want a better car. Is that resonating with people who might be listening to this saying, look, you already got what you asked for. It's time to go back to work.
Sure. I think some people do feel that way. I think some people do think the teachers are kind of killing their goodwill with lawmakers and the public by continuing to walk out of schools day after day. But not everybody feels that way. When Governor Fallon was speaking with the CBS reporter and said teachers are acting like teenagers who want a car, the CBS reporter responded by saying, yeah, but teenagers didn't have their car taken away for 10 years. And it's a good analogy. Teachers have had funding taken away from them for 10 years. And so they are going to fight to get that funding back.
Or it just may be a crummy car, an unsafe car, because it looks like the $6,100 raise that teachers did get still does not bring them up to the national average. We've heard stories about teachers who are taking out second and third jobs to keep them from having to rely on food stamps.
Yes, you're right. It brings us up to about a regional average. It's nowhere near the national average. And these cuts have taken place over 10 years or more. And a lot of people are saying it's not going to take 1 year to restore them. So some people are really asking the teachers to have patience with the legislative process and give it some time to rebuild the foundation of funding that they're asking for.
This is, of course, as we've said, the third day that classes have been canceled. Teachers have been engaging in this walkout. This is, you know, this is affecting hundreds of thousands of kids. Is patience running thin between parents who are looking for a place to put their kid during the day?
Yes, definitely. Some people's patience is wearing thin. But again, there are also parents rallying at the Capitol with the teachers because these are their kids too, and they want more money for their kids' education. So it's a split opinion in the state.
And ultimately, Emily, what ends this walkout?
What ends this walkout is more funding for the classroom. The Oklahoma Education Association, the union, is asking lawmakers to ask to pass just a couple bills that would increase money for schools. And if lawmakers could pass those bills, I think this would be over.
That's Emily Wendler. She's covering the Oklahoma Teachers Walkout for State Impact Oklahoma. It's a statewide public radio collaborative. Emily, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
President Trump had more harsh words on immigration today, tweeting this morning that U.S. border laws are very weak. And yesterday, the president told reporters he's sending the military to the front line.
We are going to be doing some things. I've been speaking with General Mattis. We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military.
The president has also made a number of statements this week criticizing the way Mexico handles migrants coming across its southern border with Guatemala. And here to look at all of this is Eric Olson. He's deputy director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
What do you think of President Trump's plans to send the military to the border?
Well, on the one hand, it's not unprecedented. I personally don't think it's all that necessary. Most of the problems are being handled now at the border by Border Patrol agents. We have 16,000 Border Patrol agents on the U.S.-Mexican border. But, you know, other presidents, including President Obama and George W. Bush, have also sent National Guardsmen to the border, and wouldn't be unusual.
But let's provide some context for those
Sure.
times, because the condition at the border was very different.
Yeah. I mean, Obama sent them basically because there was a perceived crisis from drug trafficking at the time, and it was back up to border agents at that point. And likewise, George W. Bush sent them at a time when violence, particularly in border cities like Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez, were astronomical.
Hmm. I want to play some tape here from Mexico's ambassador to the U.S., Geronimo Gutierrez. He told NPR's All Things Considered yesterday that Mexico is, in fact, taking action to address illegal border crossings.
If you look at some figures of the past years, you will see that Mexico has repatriated a very large number of Central Americans that enter Mexico through our southern border. Just in 2016, that number was around, I think, 153,000 people.
Eric, I want to get your impressions there, because it does go against something that President Trump has been claiming this week, that Mexico is doing very little, if not nothing, to stop people flowing into Mexico along its southern border. What do you think of that?
Yeah, there seems to be this misimpression that Mexico is not only doing nothing but almost encouraging people to come and flow into the United States. Nothing could be further from the truth. Look at it. In January and February of this year, Mexico detained and deported over 15,000 Central Americans. In 2015, Mexico deported more Central Americans than the United States did.
Hmm.
So to say that Mexico is ignoring this problem or sitting around with its arms crossed and encouraging people in the United States, does not match with the facts on the ground. There's an aggressive policy in Mexico to deal with this problem.
Speaking of facts on the ground, I know you've been to Mexico's southern border. What does it look like, and how porous is it?
Well, in some ways, it's similar to the U.S.-Mexico border in that there are vast areas that are open with very little infrastructure, roads, very little people living there, very sparsely populated. There are official border crossing areas that are well controlled, but there are obviously other areas where people are involved in contraband and other kinds of trafficking where they cross. That's illegal, like it happens in the United States. Mexico does not have a border patrol.
Huh.
The security perimeter on the border is mostly in the hands of the Mexican military and in particular the Mexican Navy. And they have a very strong presence in that area. And there's not an open border policy. There's not a looking the other way. Mexico has, you know, built infrastructure and has focused on improving that situation.
And Mexico is getting help from the United States, which is worth pointing out. The U.S. gives many millions of dollars to Mexico for immigration enforcement. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this has been very much a part of the U.S. security assistance program for Mexico. Well over $100 million has been destined or designated for use on the Mexican-Guatemalan border. So they support what Mexico is trying to do in that area, providing intelligence, communications equipment. They have given X-ray technology, even canine units.
Hmm.
There's a lot that goes on to strengthen the capacity of Mexico to ensure and protect its borders.
Well, in your opinion, is the United States getting a return on that investment? Is it working?
Yes, I think it is. I think there's a lot of ways in which Mexico has been trying to take control of the flow of undocumented migrants in Central America coming through. Here's the problem, however. People are leaving Central America because of the violence, because of the desperate poverty. And so many of them actually may not have the documents to enter the country, but should be allowed to file for political asylum in Mexico and in the United States. We've seen over a 300% increase in Central Americans seeking asylum in Mexico. That's really important. And Mexico has tried to expand its capacity to receive Central Americans and look at their asylum claims, just like the United States has.
We're speaking with Eric Olson. He's deputy director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. And Eric, you bring up a very good point about asylum. And it's related to this caravan that's got everybody's attention now in the news that's making its way up from Central America to the U.S. border. And we're learning now that some of the migrants in this caravan were given transit documents by the Mexican government. They are allowed to stay in Mexico now for 20 days as they make their way to the U.S. border. Others have gotten papers so that they can apply for Mexican residency visas or asylum. I mean, what's your impression, as this has become so politicized, about the way that Mexico is handling this caravan?
Well, they are trying to distinguish between those who may have a legitimate claim for asylum, and that's the 20-day permit that they're given to stay and make their case. That's not a free pass to go to the United States. I think there's a lot of misconception about that.
Mm-hmm.
Others, of course, don't have a real well-founded fear of persecution, which is the standard, and they will likely be returned if they're in the custody of the Mexican authorities. But this is a key point. There is an obligation for Mexico. There is an obligation for the United States to allow migrants to make their case if they feel they fear for their lives if they're returned.
I just wonder how Mexico treats asylum seekers. You know, is it as difficult in Mexico to be granted permission for asylum as it is, say, in the United States?
Yeah, it is not an easy thing. The numbers I've seen is that roughly 1 out of 10 cases or asylum seekers receive asylum in Mexico. It's not an automatic. It's not like you present a case and they give you asylum immediately.
Hmm.
So it's not just a simple thing. It's not a rubber stamp. And in fact, a lot of migrant rights advocates in Mexico say Mexico is not doing enough to protect those migrants who have legitimate claims to protection. The same thing that people say in the United States.
We'll put all of this into context if you could. The reason we're talking about this is because the president claims that a rush of migrants are headed to the border. In fact, we know that we are at a 45-year low for Border Patrol arrests. You know, that's important to point out. And I wonder if you think it is going to stay that way.
I think it likely will. There's always going to be pressure or push factors from Central America that compel people to seek asylum outside of the country because of extreme violence in their region. But the reality is that the numbers are down, are going down. The numbers of unaccompanied minors, children under the age of 18, apprehended at the U.S. border is down 36% so far this fiscal year.
And you think they'll stay down?
I suspect they will. I mean, you know, the natural rhythm of things is that they go up for a few months, then they go back down. But in general, they have been down. The numbers of Mexicans going to the United States is way down, as you pointed out. We're actually at net zero migration, more Mexicans leaving the United States than entering. And this appears to be a long-term trend.
Yeah, and as we know, it's all about how the economy of both countries are doing. Eric Olson, Deputy Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Eric, thanks for your insight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
On October 3, 2016, around 7:45 at night, a New Hampshire state trooper pulled over a red Hyundai with Massachusetts plates on I-95. According to the police report, the car was going 66 in a 65 and was also tailgating. The driver of the car, a guy named Alexander Temple, gave the trooper permission to search the car. And in the trunk, inside of a Whole Foods shopping bag, was $46,000 in cash, all in 20s. Temple told the officer he got the cash from his sister. When police called his sister, she said that wasn't true. So the trooper called in a canine unit. But the dog doesn't turn up any drugs. Aside from tailgating, Alex Temple hadn't apparently broken any laws. He was let go. But law enforcement, they confiscated the money.
It appears that the government is of the view that it is illegal to be traveling with $46,000 in cash.
This is Gilles Bissonnette, a lawyer with the ACLU of New Hampshire.
And it, of course, is not illegal to be traveling with $46,000 in cash. Law enforcement shouldn't be able to take people's money simply by assuming without concrete evidence that is drug-related simply due to its size.
The legal maneuver that allows the government to seize money in these cases is called civil asset forfeiture. In a sense, the property, not necessarily the person, is accused of a crime. And the case names reflect that. This one, for example, is called the U.S. versus $46,000. Asset forfeiture cases can be brought in both state and federal courts. But in 2016, New Hampshire changed its rules. It said law enforcement can only take money when someone is actually arrested, charged, and found guilty of a crime. States across the country are tightening their policies right now. Backers say, A, civil forfeiture is a system ripe with abuse, and B, that it creates the wrong incentives for law enforcement, who get to keep some of the cash. They call it policing for profit. New Hampshire's new rules, though, they don't apply to federal cases. That means all a state trooper or local officer needs to do is call in federal agents, like the FBI or Homeland Security, and they can seize the money, even if there isn't an arrest and conviction. That's what happened with the $46,000.
It's a loophole. There's definitely a loophole that allows state and local law enforcement to bypass state policy set by our legislature.
This is Greg Moore with the group Americans for Prosperity. He, along with the ACLU, pushed for the stricter state laws. This wasn't based on any specific case of fraud, but rather a philosophical belief about the role of government, that there needs to be a high bar if the state wants to take people's money. Under the Obama administration, there was a reduction in some types of federal asset forfeiture cases. But under President Trump and his Attorney General Jeff Sessions, The U.S. Department of Justice is expanding the program. Here's Sessions.
I mean, I love that program. We had so much fun doing that, taking drug dealers' money and passing it out to people trying to put drug dealers in jail. What's wrong with that?
If someone made money off of something illegal, be it selling drugs or running a Ponzi scheme, reasonable people would agree that they shouldn't get to keep the money. John Farley works in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Concord, New Hampshire. Farley can't comment on the case of Alex Temple, the $46,000 man, since his office is handling it. But he did say, look, the government is not going to bring forward cases it doesn't think it can win. And all of these cases, in the end, are decided by a federal judge or a jury.
If someone has a really legitimate defense, if they really truly were an innocent owner, if there is a legitimate explanation for why someone has this large quantity of cash, we're not going to just sit back and wait for a trial to see what happens. I mean, we're going to take that very, very seriously in how we assess what to do with that case.
Farley says that at any given time, there are roughly 1 to 2 dozen active asset forfeiture cases in New Hampshire. That may not seem like a lot, but the money here does add up. Since 2010, New Hampshire Public Radio found that law enforcement departments here received nearly $10.5 million through what's called the Federal Equitable Sharing Program. That money helps local departments fund undercover work and equipment they may not otherwise be able to afford. As for the case of the cash found in a Whole Foods shopping bag, there's been an interesting wrinkle. Alex Temple, who was driving the car, hasn't stepped forward to challenge the case. Instead, someone named Edward Phipps has filed a petition claiming that the cash is actually his. In court paperwork, the Maine resident claims the money was lawfully obtained, although he hasn't yet explained how he got it, why it was in $20 bills, or why it was in Mr. Temple's trunk. That information will likely come out during the trial of the U.S. versus $46,000, scheduled to start in December of this year. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.